You know ID in the town all day. ID in the SEA. You know ID in the town all day. ID in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode 433 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast, sponsored by our friends at Pagliacci Pizza. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we're coming to you from separate locations this week. I'm in Seattle, Washington, home of the four-time WNBA champion, Storm.
And I'm coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion and 1-0 Seattle Seahawks. You were scared last week after I dominated you for 48 minutes all the way across the floor to come back into my house in Renton, Washington. You said we're back on Zoom.
The NFC West co-leading Seattle Seahawks.
You're just moving on from that?
Well, I mean, what am I going to say to that exactly? The people
love
your performance.
Like, I like the idea that it's a competition.
Yes. This is constantly a battle, as you can tell from all of my zero MVPs. Did you ever get an MVP?
How about my zero MVPs?
Awkward silences, though. Shout out to awkward silences.
Our MVPs have moved from KD to concepts.
This is the dumbest podcast out there. I mean, you really dominated me, even though we weren't playing head-to-head, was fantasy football. It is a rough start to me defending my Peltoncast Champions League.
I think I would be getting ahead of myself if I declared the fantasy genius back. But after 1 week, after leading both leagues in points, except for Jimmer.
That's like the asterisk. It's like the end of the commercial where they read the legal stipulations, except
the
for Jimmer.
The thing that was best about it is you were so hurt about my pick of Cooper Kupp, and I did it to you. Not even playing you. Did it to you with Cooper Kupp.
I had also lost to Cooper Kupp in the other league I'm in.
I feel like you told everybody publicly on this podcast, but
I did?
Didn't specifically invoke his name.
I have no idea what I actually left in
that
at this point.
Plus Puka Nacua getting injured was just like literally the seas parted for Cooper Kupp.
They did.
If you could read you a fantasy draft, he's probably a top 10 pick now.
In this case, it was the blue seas of the Lions, so it was fitting. Well, that's not what we're going to recap from last weekend. Let's start by talking about a 2-0 weekend in Seattle for
Are we doing that before
local
toast?
Football teams. Yeah, let's do that first.
We are getting into it.
There's a lot of toasts.
Okay. Let's start with the Seahawks, right?
That's what I thought we should start with. I mean, that was the more consequential of the two games, with all due respect to Eastern Michigan.
Wow. Consequential.
Although, Bo Nix. No, still probably better than Eastern Michigan's quarterback play. Not better than their kicker, though. Pretty amazing kicker for Eastern Michigan, but that's not what we're going to talk about.
We were impressed.
You were there.
Seahawks game on Sunday. You know, it was interesting actually going to the Seahawks game just to set an atmosphere here. It was hot as hell. But it was interesting after going to two Husky games. I'm like, oh yeah, I remember what going to football games is like. And then getting down there to the Soto area around Lumen Field and just the atmosphere around Seahawks football, I was like, no offense to the Huskies, but I hadn't seen shit before. Like, the atmosphere around a Seahawks game is unlike any other sports team in the city of Seattle, any other sports team in the entire Pacific Northwest, maybe even any other sports team in the entire West Coast.
You've not been to a lot of games in Eugene.
Any.
There is a certain atmosphere there.
No, absolutely not. First off, we do not invoke the team from down south. Like, what, they're 25,000 fans? It's not an atmosphere. Sorry. I'm talking about how this doesn't compare with 67,000 strong at Husky Stadium.
But I thought 76? This wasn't... I guess I didn't understand. I thought this was like a...
No,
it rowdiness,
was,
not a...
Not even a rowdiness.
Size
the,
thing.
The quantity of people, just the whole thing. When you go to a Husky game, you're like, yeah, there are a lot of people around. It's something. This is everything. This is fucking Seahawks. This is the NFL. And this is a team that you're kind of reminded
I don't know that I buy that any of this is true, given that all of the largest football stadiums in America are for college teams.
It's still different.
I mean, if you want to say different. That it's a West Coast college football thing.
Sure.
That's a different story.
I was so
close to calling it a Pac-12 thing, but it's not anymore.
I was struck getting down there with just... I don't I mean, I got I've had season tickets for I don't even know what the first year was, the Jim Elmore season.
So that was 2008. No, 2009. 2008 was home runs last year.
So this is my 15th year. That's crazy. I'm way too old.
I don't know if
But
you got there on accident correctly. Because it's
you're taking out the COVID season. This would have been 16, or
this would be 16, but you take out the COVID season. So yes, then it's 15.
I don't agree with taking out the COVID season. I am taking the L on that one because I do not agree with taking out the COVID season. You said that for like Husky football streak, and I'm like, this is 20th straight year of Husky football. I would have been there. I had the tickets.
It only would have counted if you had purchased one of the cutouts in the stands to be a
Yeah.
view.
Of
But they
the
wouldn't let us do a Peltonian cast yet on it. So what was even the point?
Oh yeah, I remember wow. I actually don't want to think about that again.
Oh,
But
no, please don't.
anyway, I was just reminded of what it's like going to a Seahawks game. And the other thing that I was reminded of is how many fucking Broncos fans there were at the game. It was shocking. I don't remember the Broncos being an amazing traveling, like a good traveling team, but not one of those teams that you play where you're like the Packers is one where you're just like, this is going to be horrible, the amount of Packers fans. Broncos fans came out. I think early season games, I think week one, week two, people do a lot of traveling for those games. It's sunny outside. I also,
I was going to say, when was the last time the Broncos were here? And then I remembered it was literally 2 years ago. It was
and
also week
it
one,
wasn't like that.
but
It
it was a
I think
Monday night.
that was a little bit different though. Yeah, it was Monday night. It was obviously Russell Wilson's return. There were Broncos fans, but it wasn't like this.
I also don't think Seahawks fans were as eager to single game resell their tickets for that one as
I'm
they
kind
might
of
have been for this
surprised
one.
how much they I have no idea.
I'm
But
just saying that was like, in some ways, the
like we
biggest
had to show up for
non-playoff
that one.
Seahawks game ever.
So the Broncos obviously is a big fan base, but this was to me the biggest Broncos fan base that I think I'd seen. And they were loud, they were annoying, and the other thing that I did know was coming that is now cemented is the Broncos are the team of Oregon. There is an evil axis now between the Denver Broncos and the team from down south. It is uncomfortable. In front of us, two rows in front of us, there was a person wearing a green jersey of the team from down south, cheering the whole game for the Broncos. It is deep inside their core for these people. So it was an uncomfortable situation, especially as the previous day. Look, the Husky win was nice. But the game that I was cheering the most for, that I was dancing for, yelling for, we were screaming at the top of our lungs, happened on Saturday night. And it was featuring maybe a new Pac-12 team. But that was the game that I was most excited about on Saturday, not the Husky game. So I had spent hours on Saturday night cheering against the team from down south, being this like I actually felt like the pit in my stomach of upsetness about
Wow.
it. Yeah, that's no. It's not as real for you as it is for me, but like,
It is
I
not.
care
It's not
about
anywhere
this.
close. It's just not even close for me.
It's kind of crazy because really, just abhorrent situation. I don't even want to think about that. So seeing their quarterback from last year come in here and just being like, I have to have faith in Mike McDonald to shut this down. And do you want to know what Mike McDonald did on Sunday in Seattle, Washington?
What do you do?
He shut that shit down. He fucking delivered in game one. You have to give credit to, I mean, because again, this, in a lot of ways, this is the same defense personnel wise that we saw last year. And in a lot of other ways, this is the diametric opposite of the defense that we saw last year. It really is hard not to have revisionist history of what could have been from the Seahawks defense. I love Pete Carroll. This is not even necessarily an anti-Pete Carroll take, but if they were just one Pete Carroll away from having that defense, why did this not happen sooner? Why did the Seahawks choose Pete Carroll over Russell Wilson? I get that the Russell Wilson trade led to some of those defenders who were playing in the game, one notable one, but good God, people. Like, how many years of our lives did we waste on this defense when there was another defense that was out there to be played? And Mike McDonald showed us that defense on Sunday in Seattle. This was a game we could talk about offense, we could talk about anything else. this was a game about the Seattle Seahawks defense.
First off, I want to say Mike McDonald wasn't necessarily out there to be the next head coach of the Seahawks before last offseason. So in the same way that the Jamal Adams trade was actually great, that it led to Russell Wilson waiting out the Pete Carroll era, if it led us to this Mike McDonald defense, was maybe all worth it. I was thinking that the other thing you were going to say this game reminded you of was the Legion of Boom, because that's what I was reminded of. Like, the flying around on defense, the quality of the tackling, it was all very early Pete Carroll era Seahawks in a way that we didn't see in the past 5 and 6 years.
Schematically,
I mean, it is different. Yeah, like, you know, down.
It is a schematic different defense. And
I mean,
and that was
I mean,
the
they
thing.
Didn't play, they played, didn't play any coverage more than I think it was 17% of the time, Daniel Jeremiah said on local radio or a podcast.
Really? So they were playing all sorts of different coverages.
Yeah.
They were mixing it up so much that the Broncos couldn't even get comfortable.
And which is very much the opposite, yes, of the Pete Carroll style. We're going to do what we do, and we're just going to do it so well.
We're just
going to
show you exactly what's happening and let you beat it over and over and over again.
And I mean, that's one of the awesome things about football is that you, like, Pete Carroll didn't necessarily play that style that successfully the last few years, but you can play that style successfully. Or you can play a Mike McDonald or a Belichick, as we'll talk about, I'm sure, later, style, and be very successful changing things all the time and creating confusion. And that's part of the stylistic diversity that makes football fun.
The thing that impressed me the most about the defense, and you could see it almost immediately. I mean, you know, the first drive was, it was kind of shocking, just like how much it took the air out of the building, right? Because you have like big anthem, another flyover, back-to-back flyover days for me. Another flyover, you're feeling it, right? It is week one, Seahawks Broncos. Finally, we're back. It's a whole new era of Seahawks football. And they come out with one of the worst offensive possessions I think I've ever seen.
It was pretty brutal.
And the pick was just like, it was a shocking interception. It was like, I don't even know, like, I don't know what Geno, and I think Geno overall played a good game, but I do not know what Geno saw on that play.
I mean, he was getting hit. It was a big part of it.
But even if he wasn't getting hit, he still was throwing into like double coverage. It was
I haven't looked at the all 22 on that one.
It was one of those things where you're like, even if this went exactly to plan, it still might've been intercepted. But, you know, it's the first series. It is a new offensive scheme. And that's what I kept thinking about in the first half of the game, was basically, this is going to take time on offense. They're going to settle in. They're going to be fine. The defense is right there. And even though they gave up a big run to start with, you could see how that defense settled down, holding the Broncos to a field goal on that first possession. And given just how bad the first offensive possession was for the Seahawks, to only be down 3-0 was a pretty incredible place to be.
I mean, some similarities certainly in that regard to the UW game. The UW offense got going much, much earlier than the Seahawks offense did and was not quite as self-defeating in terms of safeties. Really, the two safety half. What an amazing tribute to Pete Carroll, even though it didn't really produce scoregami numbers. Just the way we got to 11-8 was a very unusual one. This is actually, Daniel Jeremiah was on with Brock and Salk this morning. He said 21% cover quarters, 17% cover one, 17.5% cover six, 10% cover two. So they were
they're
really
like
doing everything.
Me playing college football video game, right? Where you're just like, dial it up. I don't care what's it's just like we're all over the place.
So let's talk about Bo Nix. Because I do think like there's now gonna be this kind of storyline of Bo Nix can't beat the Seattle teams. And someone like put together Bo Nix's interception in the Pac-12 championship game and the one that he threw to Reek Woolen on Sunday, and it's like, okay, Bo Nix wasn't great in the Pac-12 championship, but the game they lost in Seattle, like, Bo Nix was fucking awesome. He threw 337 yards and three touchdowns. It was just the UW offense was even better. As I said last week, I think Bo Nix was an underrated college quarterback, in that Oregon's offense not being better than it has been so far this season is a reflection of it. Sunday did reinforce a take I had on Bo Nix, which is it's similar to what I think about a lot of older college basketball prospects, is people think the reason not to draft an older prospect is because they have a low ceiling. And this is actually quite stupid when you look at several of the best players in the NBA were drafted is like 3 or 4 year college players, Steph Curry, Damian Lillard, etc., Jimmy Butler. There's not actually this low ceiling. What it is some of the times when you're playing against the guys that are 5 years younger than you and just taking advantage of your size and your basketball IQ and things like that, it doesn't translate when you go to the NBA and you're younger than everyone else. And that was how I felt about Bo Nix, where like the fact that he was such an experienced college quarterback paid off for him. But all of a sudden, you fed him, he wasn't playing against Mike McDonald at Oregon, and he got a severe
I
reality
said
check.
the exact. They were talking about Tosh Lupoy in the game against Boise State, and I was like, "Motherfucker, like Tosh Lupoy is like, he's not a defensive coach, if we're being honest here.
I mean,
Like,
I think he may have developed into one, but yes, that's not really his
he's
background.
still a recruiter, and he's somebody who ultimately is coaching like very base level. Mike McDonald's like a goddamn mastermind out there. You know, the fact that these two people are coaching the same sport is absurd. When they kept showing him there, it's like." Like, we know why this person is here. Hey,
Don't think go
don't
that
you
far.
dare say that I'm getting ahead of myself, because
I
again,
would
you could
hate to be neutral in the situation.
I we're not coming back to that. I told you exactly what the deal was last week, though. I told you exactly what it was going to be about Bo Nix. Everything they did in college was cheap. Everything that they did in college. And all of a sudden, when you're facing Mike McDonald and an NFL defense, cheap stuff doesn't work. You saw it again. I mean, they did the same shit the next or the previous night. Like, that is what you're able to do, because if you can block and you have speed that is better than the other team, the college game is all side to side,
I
more or
mean, you can still
less.
do that. That is still the 49ers offense. It's just that doing that at the college level doesn't necessarily translate to the NFL.
The 49ers offense is a lot less of that than I feel like you would think. You know,
I
like
suppose. I mean,
the
it's
49ers
relative.
offense requires a lot of going downfield. But that's basically what Bo Nix got away with at Oregon, doing that repeatedly. And all of a sudden, I was talking to Chris, and I was like, I can't wait for him to throw a pass downfield, for him to do this. And then the first one that he threw, the first time that they finally got them into like a third and long, bam, interception of Julian Love. It came out of me like it was visceral. Yelling at Bo Nix as a fan, it was just so much fun. I loved every single second of it. And I told you, I wanted that Seahawks defense to put Bo Nix through hell. And that is exactly what happened. And you saw it right there in that play. He was not ready for it. Bo Nix was not ready to look at any passes downfield. And honestly, I think I even want to take. And DVOA did this also, for what it's worth. I don't think we should just look at it defensive, adjustments based upon competition. This is still Sean Payton's the coach of the Denver Broncos. This is still ultimately a very experienced quarterback coming from college. If all of a sudden we're just going to say, well, this is a wildly bad offense, I don't think that's fair. I think the Seahawks defense is, after 1 week, one of the best in the NFL.
Probably. Yeah, I mean, look, this is the way the Seahawks defense played in the preseason. This is the way the Ravens defense played last year. I don't want to get ahead of myself, but I do think there's a lot of reason for optimism, especially because like, the advanced stats were equally effusive. I mean, the Seahawks are number, what are they here? Number one in defensive DVOA. They were number
Number
two in
one.
opponent EPA per play. Like, this was pretty incredible. I mean, the more fascinating thing, like statistically, is somehow DVOA came out of this with the Seahawks number seven in offense.
The offense was quite good. I think the offense was actually underrated in this game because
I
of a
mean,
few plays.
they were 19th in EPA per play. They were 11th in success rate. They got a lot of drives because of the fact that the defense was so good at getting off the field.
Also
Correctly predicted
drives.
that one.
Like
They
it's just
weren't
so
necessarily.
fun to watch. So fun to
It didn't
watch.
necessarily mean that many plays because just they were incapable of running plays themselves.
But the defense, we're talking about 3.3 yards per attempt. Like these are not numbers you see all that often. They weren't able to run the ball, they weren't able to pass the ball short, and they weren't able to pass the ball deep.
What does that leave?
That leaves one scramble and one ball that they caught over Trey Brown's head. But still, overall, the thing that impressed me the most was seeing short passes, and every single time there was a defender there to make a tackle, and they made the tackle.
I mean, I think the question is, I guess, when you're tested a little bit more deep, but look, again, the prayer should be, I think Shil Kapadia was correct. The prior should be that this is going to be a good defense, given what we've seen from Mike McDonald,
These
and that there is talent here. There's a considerable amount of talent. I mean, the biggest question mark about this team, like maybe to a degree, the safeties, Julian Love and Rayshon Jenkins both played awesome on Sunday. The biggest question mark was about the linebackers, and Jerome Baker and Tyrell Dodson looked like exactly the kind of linebackers that you need in this scheme in terms of their quickness.
And the pass rush looked awesome also. I kind of don't have any questions. Kayvon Wallace looked great in the game.
Their only weakness is exposure.
I mean, it kind of is true, isn't it?
Do we need to
But the
put that
other
in
things.
the Pelton cast? I guess we don't have the original link necessarily. I was going to say, do we need to put that in the glossary?
There is a quote from Urban Meyer where I don't know if this if it was actually a quote or whatever, or if it was apocryphal or where. But he described being an NFL coach, and he was like, every single week is like playing Alabama.
That was Nick Saban, wasn't it?
I no, I'm pretty sure that was Urban Meyer
Oh,
being
you're right.
like,
It
I'm
was Urban
so
Meyer.
overwhelmed.
Yeah, that was.
And it actually made me think about just like how hilarious Urban Meyer's job was at Florida, because it's like half the season they're just fucking off or whatever. You basically like literally Michigan last year had to play one game before they got to the playoff, more or less. But the There's a reality in the NFL that you don't really just like. There are going to be better offenses than the Denver Broncos,
A
obviously,
lot.
but it's not like you don't write off teams in the NFL. The Seahawks only won by 6 points at home still. Like overall, when you judge it from that perspective, you wouldn't look at it without knowing what happened in the game and also looking at it statistically and see that it was as much of an ass kicking as it was. But when you look at it statistically, it was that kind of level of ass kicking of the Broncos. But also, this is an NFL team, and that's actually the thing that like I've kind of reminded myself of heading into the season. And it's true in college also. I mean, Northern Illinois beat Notre Dame at home. Like it can happen in college. But any NFL team could beat any other NFL team any week. It is not impossible. There's no situation. And that's why you don't see massive favorites like that, because these are all really, really, really good players. And the Denver Broncos have very good offensive players. So I wouldn't just write off a performance like this. If you finish a week number one in DVOA, it is because your defense played extraordinarily well.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing about it that looks better from an advanced stats perspective, the Seahawks outgained Denver by 1.8 yards per play. I'm trying to look up where that ranked on Sunday. But and a lot of the things that went wrong in the first half were relatively fluky things, particularly the fumbled punt return by D. Williams. The Broncos had a fumble on offense that bounced directly to a teammate. The two punts that were down, or the punt and the interception that were both down at the one, like odds, you're not going to start that many play possessions all season at your 1 yard line. And they started two in the first half of the first game. So, well, you would also still like to not get safeties when you do that. We saw in the second half, I think, a little bit more representative sample of the Seahawks offense. And, I don't think it's a, I don't think, again, it was as good as seventh as they finished in DVOA. They were like 11th in success rate. And I think that's probably a more fair
That's
assessment of
fine.
where the
But if,
offense is.
like, legitimately for this offense, they played kind of a bad game. So if that's kind of, if you can play a bad game, like you look at the first, I think it goes interception, punt, punt, and then maybe there was a field goal drive or a solid drive after that. And then it's like safety, safety. Like, if you start a game that badly and still end up 11th in success rate, that's a good game that you played. Because, and I think this Broncos defense might also be a pretty solid defense overall. But like you look at Geno, he had the awesome scramble, still finished pretty efficiently passing the ball. The pick was pretty horrible, but he hit most of the passes that he needed to. And then the pass that he made to Lockett to win the game, I thought was awesome. The Ken Walker runs, like Ken Walker is, he's obviously going to be a frustrating player sometimes, but what he can do when he's on the field is, he's at a different level than other running backs in this league. So being able to kind of operate in that way with the motion and giving him the ability to kind of get in space, I think Ken Walker might have a massive season. So I don't know if you can have a bad game and start as poorly as they did, end up with two safeties and still be 11th in success rate, seventh in DVOA. That's a pretty incredible thing to have done.
Yeah, I mean, with Ken Walker, I think the big part of it is going to be, can he stay healthy? And that's the question coming out of this, is he left that game with an oblique injury. So we will see. Anything else as far as, I mean, I guess we haven't talked about the offensive line. It was a rough first half for them specifically. We saw George Fant leave with a knee injury. His status for this weekend also in question. All of a sudden, you know, we were feeling pretty good about the depth of having George Fant able to step in with Abe Lucas unavailable to start the season. And then all of a sudden, you're back at Stone Forsythe at right tackle, just like the early part of last season. And the play of the guards was not great. Not feeling particularly
Was
good
that
about
through the
that.
whole game though, or?
What, the guards?
Yeah.
I mean, Ben Baldwin pointed out on Twitter that five teams had worse grades than the Seahawks guards overall. So they did improve in the second half without question. And we did see, I think, some early indications of a potential Charles Cross breakout season.
There we go.
So that
The
was exciting.
I think the way that the offensive line kind of settled in, I mean, they lost George Fannin. What was the first series?
I don't think it was the first series, but it was not long after that.
I thought he was injured on the first series, but the to lose Fant that early, you're starting right tackle, there's some scrambling that happens in a game, you know, and it kind of can put that unit out of whack. So I still come back to in the Ryan Grubb offense, I think as much as offensive line, the impact of any individual or the skill level of them overall can be reduced slightly, I think in this offense, it is the one place that it can happen to a certain extent. Having good offensive linemen is important, but they throughout the second half, like this ultimately is not a great offensive line on paper and played pretty well in the second half of this game.
It was at the end of the first quarter that George Fant went out.
Okay.
So he was in there a little bit. Anything else you want to say on this game?
It's funny because it's a revenge game, even though we've beaten Bo Nix basically every single time that we've played him, except
Not
for
basically.
no, didn't they lose to him in Auburn? That
That
wasn't
was
him.
Jared Stidham.
Okay. Wow.
It was so long ago that even Bo Nix wasn't playing quarterback.
That's incredible. Bo Nix, after all of these years of having to deal with him, beating him over and over and over again. It must get old for Bo Nix to have played teams from Seattle, and this being his fourth consecutive time losing to a football team from Seattle, Washington. It is a complete ownership over him. And we will not be facing him. The Seahawks will not be facing him again, most likely for a very long time.
I have no idea about the Seahawks schedule. Are they playing the AFC West this year? Is this the AFC West year in 22 was the year that it was just a one-off game against the Broncos, or vice versa? I think, well, I'm not really sure anymore.
And as I saw that second interception that Bo
This is the
Nix threw,
one-off year. So
when do they play the AFC West?
that would be 2026.
Okay,
Presumably.
that's a long
Or, yeah,
time
2026. Yeah.
before, because I'll tell you, there's not going to be another game that the AFC and the NFC is going to be playing Bo Nix. After seeing that second interception, which could have easily been interception number four, despite the fact that he played in just his first ever NFL game, your 24-year-old quarterback is already washed Denver Broncos. Bo Nix, retire, bitch! Woo! Oh my God, did I love it? I loved it so much at Lumen Field on Sunday. I'm mad at you that we did an emergency pod after it. My voice was hoarse. It was my favorite thing to have ever seen. And beating Bo Nix is my favorite activity that football teams from Seattle routinely do.
It is now three times in 11 months, give or take. All right, let's talk about this, the Huskies versus Eastern Michigan on Saturday, a game that, as I mentioned, started slowly. Huskies trailed 3-0 after the first quarter, and all of a sudden you started to have a lot of questions, not about whether they were going to win that game necessarily, but like, ooh, how is this going to work going forward? But then very quickly the offense got unstuck. I mean, it was They were in a tough situation. They were in a fourth and one at their own 30 that Jed Fish decided to go for. Crucial moment.
Balls.
29-yard completion to Giles Jackson, and that got the offense going. The other thing that kind of gets forgotten is the only reason the offense had the ball down only 3-0 at that point is because Eastern quarterback Cole Snyder fumbled at the end of a long scramble when they were looking to add to that lead on one of their better offensive possessions. So
And
it
do you want to know what that play, that fourth and one from the 39, looked like to, I mean, Sean Payton the very next day, right? Do you want to know what that play looked like? Antonio Pierce, like 20 yards ahead of there, maybe even more.
What's that?
What that looked like to most coaches, maybe to most coaches, it looked like a punt.
Yes.
And to Jed Fish, it didn't. And what it did is it meant the first touchdown in the game for the Huskies, a lead that they would not relent for the rest of the game.
Not relinquish, I believe, is what you
Relinquish?
were
There we
looking
go.
for. They didn't relent either necessarily, but they certainly did not relinquish the lead en route to a 30-9 victory. Which is almost exactly Baby Fantasy Genius asked me for my prediction. I said 31 to 10. So I'm feeling pretty good about that one. Will Rogers finished 21 of 26, beating his week one performance of 20 of 26 by one completion. So looking forward to 22 of 26 coming this week in the Apple Cup. Eventually, we'll
But
progress
let me
up
tell
to
you,
27 of 26.
those performances might have been one incompletion off, but if you look at QBR, they're like 50 points separate. So there was a big difference between these two performances from Will Rogers. Don't get it twisted.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think he had a very strong day. Found Jeremiah Hunter repeatedly times, five catches for 72 yards and a touchdown after he was shut out in week one. Denzel Boston didn't have a big day necessarily, but caught a pair of touchdowns. And then our guy, Decker DeGraff, sadly,
Oh.
he did catch a non-touchdown and did have, I think, a bit of a drop at one point, but he started his career with two consecutive catches, two touchdowns
It's
in his
kind of
debut win.
interesting how QBR functions, but like, I guess they said they had no sacks on against Eastern. It was just a 7 yard rush that he lost. I don't know what the difference is. His rushing was one carry for negative 7 yards, but it doesn't have him listed as a sack. So who knows? But why QBR saw those two things is so different. Because again, it was one completion, it was 11 extra yards, it was three more touchdowns, and it was two less sacks. But
I mean, the
just
sacks are pretty big EPA per plays, so that matters. And then I think there is a bit of a touchdown bonus in terms of EPA.
this Will Rogers performance, though, that he had against Eastern. I mean, a 93 QBR is still a very good place to be. So I'm definitely pleased with how he's looked overall and how efficient he was. Like, the other thing about Will Rogers so far, again, it's been Weber State and Eastern Michigan, is he doesn't look like the quarterback that people feared he was. And I think people got a little bit deluded into thinking that him operating in a Mike Leach offense meant that he was a Mike Leach quarterback. And sometimes the circumstances and the situation around you is more important than the individual player. We know that, right? So if all of a sudden Rodgers was gunslinging, like the pressure that he was getting, how quickly it was, the scheme overall, it kind of forced Will Rogers to be that type of quarterback. But Jed Fish and the offense that he runs is different. And so far, Will Rogers has been able to execute in this UW offense.
Yeah, I mean, we're going to start see more of a test of it starting this weekend when the competition stiffens. But I felt better about Will Rogers after watching him in the spring game and seeing him push the ball down the field, and I continue to feel good about Will Rogers, even though I did make some remarks in the first quarter about my bold prediction that Austin Mack was going to take the
Fucking
starting
Austin
job.
Mack. I don't know what team he's going to be starting for. East Carolina, maybe. Where do you think Austin Mack starts his next game? I'll tell you, it is not Alabama.
Maybe one of the schools that's heading to the Pac-12. We'll talk about that later.
I'll give you every other school. Where's QBR rate leaders though? I want to see this complete leaders passing.
I mean, now that's unadjusted QBR, isn't it? I don't, is that adjusted on the player page? I believe it is not.
Where can you see QBR leaders on ESPN though? Because I'm curious, just his game in week two, where that would have ranked Will Rogers overall.
All right. The current leader is Joe Fagnano, and Cam Ward's second at 94.9.
Oh,
That would have ranked him
Cam Ward is really good.
sixth. By the way, our guy John Mateer is eighth in QBR. They love a
What about just
scrambler.
the scrambling? Quarterback from down south of 49 and a 56 in his first two performances. So just keep that in mind when you're spending $2 million on quarterbacks in NIL. But
Rodgers' unadjusted QBR through two games is 87. His adjusted QBR is 70. So there is a pretty significant schedule
that's fine.
adjustment.
The other piece that I think was great about this game was I did, look, put him in the Pantheon already. It's been two games, but I don't know if they were, do they retire jerseys in Husky football?
No.
Oh, because
They don't have that many numbers to go around, especially if they're
number
number
one,
one.
anytime the next time we're on episode one of the Pelton cast, whatever it is, 401's the next one.
Well, that's going to be the Highline School District episode.
Oh, fuck. Okay, episode 501.
Actually, we've already passed 401. 501 is the next one.
Episode 501 is the Jonah Coleman edition of the Pelton cast, a dog, and that they got him to 100 yards on only 11 carries. They gave him Milton Berle with Jonah Coleman. It was like,
Well, they
look,
very specifically brought him back in to get him to 100 yards.
we do not have to do too much here with Jonah Coleman saving him. Just batch it up. Save all those hits on his body because Jonah Coleman still is this offense right now. No matter what, whatever happens with Will Rogers, Jonah Coleman is the offense. He's going to be the offense long term. Having a player like that is, and I think will also make a difference against a team like Wazoo.
Had a 64-yard carry. Cam Davis, 6 for 42 off the bench. Adam Muhammad got a little more early playing time, 3 carries for 26 yards. So yeah, feel very good about the state of the UW run game. Defensively, I would say somewhat similar to week one, that Eastern was able to move the ball at times, ended up kicking three field goals. A couple of them, I think two of the three were 50+ yards. So a crucial fourth down stop after the Huskies had a punt blocked on their opening possession. Zach Durfee, 2.5 sacks, the breakout game we've all been waiting for. No one more than Zach Durfee after he was ineligible until the college football playoff last year. And then four other players had a sack plus a half for Javon Parker. So you love to see it.
Yeah, I and again, this it's Eastern, but not having given up a touchdown right now, teams from Seattle, Washington don't even have as many touchdowns given up as teams from Seattle, Washington have consecutive wins against Bo Nix.
I mean, it's not even close. It's lopsided in favor
So
of the Bo Nix victory streak.
having only given up one touchdown in three games so far between these two teams. I mean, teams like Eastern Michigan, teams like Weber State score touchdowns against you, even kind of just random touchdowns, right? I mean, they got to the goal line. And for the Huskies not to have, they will this Sunday or this Saturday, but to not have given up a single touchdown across these first two games, it does matter whether it's Weber State and Eastern Michigan or not.
All right, anything else on this one?
I was very positive. I will see how I feel on Saturday and then
It's
maybe
Apple Cup
Sunday.
week, by the way. You shouldn't be saying that in September, but it is Apple Cup week. We'll
I
talk
was
about that later.
very excited preseason. I was very confident about both of these coaching hires. Seeing people on Michigan Reddit boards talking about how they should have hired Jed Fish. Oh, it is a sweet thing. But I feel like everything that I'm going to say I had talked about because you were a lot more negative about all things, not
I
just football
was
related, throughout your whole life.
neutral.
Look, you've been a lot more than neutral, a lot more negative than neutral. But you spent the entire first quarter glaring at me.
You said that that Eastern Michigan wasn't outplaying UW at that point, and they were. They undoubtedly were.
Sure.
It's fine, but they were.
I was feeling very positive about both of these coaching hires, and I was feeling like both of these rosters were underrated heading into the season. And through the very large sample size of three games, two of them being against Eastern Michigan and Weber State, how can I not take a victory lap after those because everything that we talked about has
Please
played out
don't
in
make
these
premature
games.
victory laps the 2025 Pelton Cast MVP. I mean, the thing I will say, I don't think UW has changed its outlook for the season appreciably through two games. We're just going to find out a lot more starting on Saturday.
I mean, I think the people who have changed their outlook in these two games appreciably have been Penn State having a very difficult time winning.
Fair.
Oregon, the team from down south, having a very difficult time winning. Like Michigan getting slaughtered by Texas. You know, like basically the three most difficult teams on their schedule right now have either lost a game or have looked pretty shaky. So I think it's maybe more about that than it is anything else necessarily. But we'll talk about this.
I mean, I
there
forget.
Is a team on the schedule that's looked pretty good so far.
I mean, there's multiple teams on the schedule that have looked pretty good so far. I forget what their win projection was going into week one. I think it was like 6.6 wins, I want to say, going into last week, and now it's up to 7.2. So, I mean, that is like a moderate, but like the Seahawks are 10th in Dave now.
Where do they start?
I'm not 100% sure, but lower than that. And they're now projected to win 10 games on average and make the playoffs 64% of the time. So
there we go.
Your Seahawks overpick is looking very
after
strong.
One game. The thing that is going to win the MVP for this year is not premature victory laps. It is deserved overconfidence.
Oh, God. Oh,
you should always judge a football season after week one and or two.
That could be one of the premature victory laps. All right. Let's move to the toasts. Sticking on the weekend, congrats to Albert Rushnak, who recorded the 8th hat trick in Sounders MLS history on Saturday at Columbus Crew and was named MLS Player of the Match Day. It's Rushnak's first career MLS hat trick. We'll talk about the asterisk to that one in the roundup. Do you know this story?
No.
Oh, that's going to be a fun one for you to learn.
I'm very fascinated.
Congrats to you.
I'm a little concerned.
No, I mean, there's no concern. It's just like, it's not as impressive as it sounds once you find out the full context.
Oh, no, I actually do. You're talking in the context of how he scored the goals?
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh,
no,
okay.
I'm aware.
Oh,
yeah,
disappointing.
Chris explained it to me. I was like, wow, that was a big win. He was like, yeah, here's what happened. he was so convinced that the Sounders, who obviously he knows more about this than I do, but like, he was so convinced that the Sounders were going to lose that he wasn't even going to like watch the match, basically.
That's funny. I did not watch the match as I was at the Storm game and going to that. All right, congrats to you to men's soccer on another ranked victory, this time over crosstown rival number 11,
Just
Seattle
U. Like I told you.
2-1 at Husky Soccer Stadium. It's
deserved
not a new coach,
overconfidence.
On Monday to win the Fueen Cup, getting goals from Richie Aman and Cooper Brunel, the Huskies went 3-1-2 in non-conference play.
No relation?
I don't believe so. In fact, now that I think of it, it might be pronounced differently, but I'm still going to pronounce it Brunel. Went 3-1-2 in non-conference play. We're ranked number 24 entering that game, so should move up if things go well this weekend. They will open their first trip through the Big Ten Friday at Michigan State. And UW senior Chris Myers, no relation, was named Big Ten Defensive Player of the Week after assisting on the
opening
goal.
Any relation to Wade Boggs?
All right, congrats to UW women's golf coach Mary Lou Moeffler, who announced that her 42nd season at UW next spring will be her final one. Moeffler played at UW, led school to the 2016 NCAA title, reaching regionals in all 30 possible seasons since they were introduced in women's golf in 1993. Moeffler is a 3-time Pac-12 Coach of the Year, a 2-time Golf Week National Coach of the Year. So definitely a toast to her. We also this week say farewell to U.S. Women's National Team legend Alex Morgan, who announced her retirement at age 35. Morgan also announced she's pregnant with her second child with longtime Sounder Servando Carrasco and played
Hello.
One final game Sunday for the hated rival San Diego Wave.
Alex Morgan is married to Servando Carrasco?
Yeah, that happened a long time ago. When
most
he was playing for the
Sounder. Most famously known for me not knowing what his first name is until right this second.
Morgan, you'll recall, played 3 matches in Seattle in 2012 for the Sounders women in between the demise of the WPS and the forming of the NWSL, scoring 2 goals with 2 assists.
You know I recall that.
So she's a Seattle legend.
There
and
we
it,
go.
it is also apparently farewell to the Big Maple, As James Paxton told the Baseball Isn't Boring podcast, he plans to retire at season's end. Paxton turns 36 in November and suffered a season-ending calf injury last month after rejoining the Red Sox. He spent parts of 7 seasons with the Mariners, who drafted him in 2010, and threw the first road no-hitter in Mariners history in his native Canada in 2018
Oh, people
against the
will
Blue Jays.
remember the hot take where I sang "O Canada" and
Oh.
inserted lyrics about. We've been doing Mariners hot takes for that long.
I guess we have.
Wow.
Today I learned.
And did the Mariners announce any plans to retire as well?
No, they are. Look, their playoff odds are still not retired. Still working. Just faintly, but they're still working.
Okay. No, I've always loved the Big Maple. Gotta
Yeah.
love him.
Oh, I mean, it was a bummer that he was only able to pitch one game before the Tommy John when he came back in 21, but such is life. All right, a quick NBA Seattle update sponsored by our friends at Pagliacci Pizza. Adam Silver spoke after the NBA's Board of Governors meetings on Tuesday in New York. Chris Daniels from Como News was there and asked him a couple of questions about the expansion process, where Silver said that it was not a big topic. There was not a lot of discussion in this meeting about expansion, but only largely not for lack of interest. It was that we had said to them we're not quite ready. I appreciate your pointing out that it's kind of not quite. I might technically, is it fall yet? He said, because he had previously said the expansion process would start in the fall. Maybe not yet. It's feeling a little bit chillier in New York, so we're getting close to fall. But it was something that we told our board we plan to address this season, and we're not quite ready yet. But I think there's certainly interest in the process, and I think we're not there yet in terms of having made any specific decisions about markets or even, frankly, to expand. I know I've s said this before. I think over time organizations should grow. It is appropriate, but it gets a bit complicated in terms of selling equity in the league, what that means for the existing television relationships, etc. What we've told interested parties is thank you for your interest. We'll be back to you. And that's certainly the case in Seattle as well. So Daniels followed up by asking about Climate Pledge Arena. Is there anybody from the NBA doing an assessment of that building, how that works with those exhibition games, now the third in Seattle? And Silver said, the answer is yes. We're always paying attention to what's happening in other arenas throughout the United States when we do play games there. We look very closely at the support we get in those markets. I know we're going to get tremendous support around that preseason game again. But incidentally, we look everywhere. I think we have a pretty good library now of arenas everywhere in the world. And in part because even if we're not playing there on a regular basis, there's things we can learn.
Does this mean anything?
It means that they have not started the expansion process yet. But we'll later this season. So stay
Okay.
tuned for some more
Okay.
coverage on this topic.
I'm doing the like Larry David looking at you thing.
Stay tuned for more coverage on this topic coming soon.
Okay. It isn't fall, technically speaking.
You know, I don't know if we want to get into a whole discussion about meteorological fall versus
But pumpkin spice latte fall? What is the other fall?
No, but there's like meteorological. I don't know if I'm saying that right. I believe it's sun. It's September through November. Yeah, fall is September through November in terms of meteorology.
Meteorologically speaking?
Yeah,
Okay.
because September is like clearly way closer to October and November weather than December is.
I agree with that.
Like the idea that December 1st is fall is preposterous.
All right,
Crab
fine. I'll
Rangoon, things
take
of that
it.
nature.
I'll take it. And
But
it
no.
is fall, Adam Silver.
I
We don't care about the autumnal equinox at all
mean, that's the spirit.
in these parts.
Hilton cast of meteorology. All right, but anyways, we'll have more coverage of this to come. With that,
I actually do agree with you. And there's
what?
not your favorite segment if that's what you're going to introduce.
I didn't think so.
The only thing that I'm going to say, I wanted so badly to push the Mariners into the rundown because they're in their own special place right now, right?
Yes.
And every loss that they have, I want to demote the Mariners. And right as I'm about to, they come back and the A's get sweep the Astros. Is that right?
They took the first 2 out of 3. They still play
They
Thursday
play again
afternoon.
tomorrow. Okay. The A's take the first 2 out of 3 from the Astros. And as long as the Mariners are within sniffing distance of a sweep in Houston, putting them within a half game or something of the division, I kind of can't kick them. We kind of can't kick them down to the rundown. So
we can't.
This is not a hot take. I would never, ever make a hot take about the Mariners right now. We'll see what happens over this next week. We're still monitoring. We are monitoring everything.
But not looking. 3.5 back of Houston, which has lost 3 in a row, 6 of their last 8. After Thursday's series finale against Oakland, 7 of the 10 Astros games before the Mariners' next visit in the final week of the season are against the Angels. So that's why the playoff odds are still as slim as they are. The latest FanGraphs update after Thursday night has it, or Wednesday night has it, at 8.6% to make the playoffs. Brian Wu took a perfect game into the seventh inning on Wednesday night against the Padres.
Let me just notify everybody and tell them that I have a bone to pick with them.
Okay.
I was getting push notifications. The broadcast was talking about it. Do we not have unwritten rules in baseball anymore?
I know Dave Sims specifically has said he does not believe in not mentioning perfect games or no hitters.
What do you mean he doesn't believe in them and not talk? You cut out there. He doesn't believe in not talking about it?
Correct.
So he thinks every inning perfect through the first. We'll see. Come on.
It's got to get to the point where it's notable. I mean, I appreciated the heads up on Twitter.
I was going to say that's why Dave Sims has never called a perfect game, but God damn it, he has. There have only been 24 in history. That's the thing. Actually, there are so many broadcasters who've gone their entire careers without ever calling a perfect game. I'm just assuming Dave Sims was in 2012, right?
He was. I think that was might have been his first season with the Mariners. Yes, he called two, actually. He's called two.
What's that? Of course Dave Sims doesn't believe in it.
Phillip Humber, also that same season.
Oh, because he called it for the Mariners broadcast?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Well, yeah. That
I believe
makes sense.
According to
Dave
Wikipedia,
Sims...
he was on Fox calling it. But
oh.
But
I mean,
obviously
he has to be up
the
there with people who have called. There have only been 24 of these fuckers in history, Dave.
The first time that one broadcaster has called two perfect games in the same Major League Baseball season.
It's one of those things where people are like athletes when they're like, thank God for everything. It's like, yeah, dude, I would also be thanking God for everything. If I were able to do these things, I would also be thanking God.
Wow.
Dave Sims, if you've called two perfect games, you're like, fuck, I'll talk about a perfect game whenever. They're constantly happening to me. But there are so many broadcasters who never in their entire lives call a perfect game.
Correlation is causation. You should talk about perfect games more. That's what I'm taking from this.
Should be. Fair enough. Okay. Well, today, again, I'm getting push notifications. Like it was the end of, I think it was the end of the sixth that they really started talking about it. And then I felt like,
I mean, what I saw on Twitter,
ESPN was talking about it. And because
Brian Wu has retired 18 consecutive batters. So
thank you, Twitter. That's fine. That is fine.
My buddy Tim Booth of the AP posted
Tim
that.
I
had to think for a second, like, what inning are they in? Has this been like there was a hit in the 18 consecutive batters?
How long did it take you to figure out what? Okay, because they didn't say from the first batter,
right?
So it could have been that there. That makes more sense because I was going to say.
You didn't say the first 18 consecutive batters. Yeah, I would have got that.
So
would have got that.
Here's where you should compliment me as a parent. We got home from first baseball practice of the year, in fact. And can I just complain also about my child for a second? I think I told you this, that...
I suppose it's your child.
Before, like 2 weeks ago, we get baseball schedule, and he's just like, oh God, I have to start baseball again. He's like, I'm just not a ball player. I'm not cut out for this. And then this motherfucker gets out there. First practice of the season. He's leading warmups, calling out stuff. He's like, arm circles big wide now. And I'm like, are you fucking kidding me? Child who is sniveling about what?
This isn't playing baseball that you're talking about. You understand what this is.
He's a coach.
it's in the blood.
A natural born
coach.
You
can't not do it.
I'm actually a little afraid that he'll grow up and be a baseball coach.
I think it's very plausible.
This is like my version of Jan saying that you'll work at the Little Nickel or whatever.
I believe it was like, the Wenatchee world.
I swear she mentioned the Little Nickel, but I don't know if they have editorial.
No, I actually think it was Walla Walla. The Wenatchee World is just funnier because I know what the name of the newspaper is, and I don't know the name of the, might be like the Press Democrat.
Isn't that the Tri-Cities one?
No.
The
Press
Tri-Cities
City's
Herald, of
Herald.
course.
Everyone
Yeah.
knows that.
There is one Press Democrat. What a funny name.
I think that might be Yakima.
I feel like we haven't talked lately about how our mom bet against both of us.
Oh, Walla Walla is the Union Bulletin. I'm way off.
Wow. You couldn't even get a job there. But anyway, we get home from baseball practice. And he's like, Dad, there's a zero up there. And I'm like, that's perfect, right? 12 years old, just Dad, there's a zero up there. That's all you needed to say. And I was like, okay. I actually told him I thought he read the score wrong because I looked at it wrong. I thought the score was 3-2.
Well, you should know better than to correct. I'm pretty much almost any of your children,
That's
but
actually fair.
particularly Luca.
Anyway, it was spoiled because of everybody talking about it, including myself.
Well, people were not talking about Luis Castillo. People were apparently talking about Luis Castillo's health on Sunday. On Saturday, was it Sunday? Sunday, when he left the win, it was Saturday. After three innings with a hamstring strain, he was placed on the injured list Monday with Sebi Zavala returning from Tacoma. I may have all these dates off. May have been Sunday. He was placed on the injured list
I'm
Tuesday.
pretty sure it was Sunday, yeah.
Yeah, but we have buried the lead here because it's been so long since this actually happened. Right after we last recorded, Jerry DePoto set to return for 2025 on a new contract, according to Ryan Divish and Adam Jude, who reported that DePoto was in the final year of his contract, as when he previously signed an extension in 2021 and was promoted to president of baseball operations, and his contract before that as well. Apparently, he's always gone into the last year of his deal. So that did provide the Mariners the opportunity to walk away from him after this, what has been disappointing season, and they have chosen not to do so.
So far.
That's why I said what has been.
Okay.
Do you have a take here? Obviously, you don't have a hot take.
Jerry DePoto, a Mariners GM, somehow decides to bet on himself. That's the most shocking thing that well, I guess decision-making executive for the Seattle Mariners, a team that has made the playoffs one single time since 2001, has bet on himself multiple times heading into the last year of a deal.
I mean, I don't know what his alternative is necessarily.
Like maybe the Mariners are not wanting to negotiate with him.
Right.
But I think this is fine, actually. Like without, I have no hot take about it. I think I actually feel like given the circumstances that Jerry DePoto is doing better as Mariners decision-making front office executive than you do. I feel like he's in like the 70th plus percentile, again, given the circumstances.
Yeah, I mean, this offseason just went very poorly. The acquisitions of the Mitchs have not worked out. Jorge Polanco has not worked out. So I guess it depends to a degree how much you weight those, and then obviously how much you weight his difficulty communicating the message publicly, which thankfully Justin Hollander is doing a lot more of now. But I certainly think it's at least as likely as not that the Mariners would hire someone worse if they replaced Jerry DePoto. So that's thoroughly fine to me. So not a lot else to say, but we'll even with a new contract, the pressure will be on DePoto going into 2025, barring a miracle comeback in the final 2 weeks of the
Do you
season.
feel like that we're in miracle territory? If they make the playoffs, it qualifies as a miracle.
I mean, I think where the playoff odds were at some point, yeah. Okay, we can debate
I
that.
don't
We can
agree.
ponder that.
Yeah, we're not going to need to ponder it because it's not going to happen.
Okay. We
But
cannot ponder that.
even if it still did, despite my lack of confidence in it, still not a miracle. You have to be at like 1% for it to be a miracle trip to the playoffs.
I don't know where they bottomed out. Let me do the odds
They
graph.
definitely didn't. I feel like they're like close to bottomed out right now.
No, I mean they were worse yesterday. Fun fact. I've kind of, Which was the game I attended, by the way. I
Oh yeah, you went
definitely
to a
attended the
Mariners
wrong
game.
game.
I was so shocked by this information.
Had seats. One of the things I did not point out on Instagram when I was posting about this is sitting two seats to my left was former Mariners starter Gil Mesh.
Wow. Name
So,
dropping again, huh?
yeah, right there is the salmon were stuck trying to get off the field, delaying play
Oh, I saw
at the start
that.
of
They were
the
like
fourth
Humpies having a hard time getting off the field. That must have been the most exciting part of the whole night. Walk
I
us
mean,
through from the beginning, the salmon race, and then what happened with Humpy, and how did you know he was Gilmesh?
my friend told me who got me the tickets.
He was like, "Hey guy,
Shout out to friend of the pod, Todd.
that's Gilmesh over there."
No, he had told me previously that Gilmesh was going to be sitting next to us. He had been informed of this when he received the tickets. And then reminded me during the game because I completely forgot to double check that
He
Gilmesh. Gil.
reminded you during the game?
Well, at some point when we were not sitting next to him, Gilmesh started the first game ever at then Safeco Field, right? Am I remembering
Wow.
this correctly? That's like a pretty amazing claim to fame, all things considered.
Is it?
Yeah, you don't think so? There's only
No.
one person can be the
You're
first
being
person who
way
started.
too liberal. Usually you're the one who polices language. You're being way too liberal with this language. It's an amazing that a starting pitcher who is on the team at the time, like there's like a 1 in 5 chance.
I mean,
Even
yeah, but you don't, not every starting pitcher is on a team when they open a new stadium. It's pretty rare.
it's a
They've only done
coincidence.
it 2 times in Mariners history.
It's a coin not even a coincidence. It's a footnote is what you're
Trivia?
trying to say. But it's not, I guess, trivia.
I mean,
He would have thrown the first pitch at Safeco Field, right?
correct.
Now T-Mobile Park. All right, fine. It is trivia at best. Amazing. A miracle that you were sitting next to Gilmesh.
This may also not be true. Fun fact.
What? That's even better if it's not true. Was it Freddy Garcia? No, that.
No, that's way too early for Freddy Garcia. Or no, I guess it wasn't way too early. All right, hold on. What was the first
So
one?
good.
First game at T Safeco Field. All right, July 15th, 1999, apparently. Do to do.
Well, so was that coming back from the All-Star
Oh, Jamie
break?
Moyer started it. Wow. Oh man, I was.
Wow, who would have thought it'd be the most obvious player?
I don't know. I very much associate that with Gilmesh. He debuted 9 days before this, so I guess that's what I'm conflating. So there
It's
you go.
not a factoid about Ken Cloud, I don't care.
There. Anyways, the salmon race
Yeah, tell
ended
us about Humpy, most importantly.
right in front of us, and we were like, 4 seats down from the hole in the mesh, that
There was
covers
a
the
he had a hole in him?
no, there's a hole in, the mesh
Gilmesh?
that
Oh, like a
the
screen.
screen. There's a hole in the screen so
Oh.
that people can go in and out from the field and back.
You're talking
And
about
it was
like.
closed, and they kind of ran towards the dugout,
Oh,
which
is that frowned upon?
it is frowned upon. No, they're not in uniforms. They're not allowed in the dugout.
So funny.
So there you go. There's
So
a
they go
detail.
through the net though. You open
Yeah.
up the net and that's where the salmon run. I've never sat in that
That's
area
where they come
before.
in, yeah.
So
And
they come down the stairs?
they go up the stairs. I don't know where they enter because the
How much
race starts
crowd
in
work?
center field. So I think they're probably just walking through the gate in center field.
Yes. How much crowd work did the salmon do after the salmon race?
I didn't catch a lot of it.
Humpy's the runaway
The
star, right? We should just get rid of the moose and just all Humpy mascot.
moose was doing some interaction with the Mariners employee in the row behind me. So that was entertaining.
Gilmesh, he's not a Mariners employee
No,
anymore.
not Gilmesh. Not everyone in the world is Gilmesh. There you go. 0-1
Humpy
in
for
Mariners games
mascot.
this season, and I did not see Hot Dogs from Heaven. Was very disappointed.
Wait, they didn't even do it?
Didn't do it.
Wow. You got to see the salmon race. It doesn't matter. Hot dogs from heaven, who cares? Salmon race is all that matters.
I see. I was talking my My friend Todd works in game operations, and he was asking how much the salmon race has caught on. And I was like, no, it's all about the hot dogs from heaven. That's all anyone cares about.
I do not agree with that.
Wow. Okay. Well, I guess maybe my perspective was biased here. I guess. Well, tell us on the Discord.
In ballpark, Humpy matters. I mean, maybe not to
I
curmudgeonly
don't
old
know
people.
what the names of any of these salmon are, to be clear.
You don't?
You
Fucking
keep using the
king. That
names.
guy's an asshole.
One of them seemed.
I love it. Feels like an I think you should leave sketch that we have feelings about mascots racing.
I definitely have feelings about the Milwaukee sausages.
About the different sausages. You're
Yeah.
like, boo, I hate you, king.
There's an Italian sausage.
Okay, fair enough. Did you hear an Italian won the US Open, I think?
I did hear that, yes.
We dominate everything.
Apparently we're very good at tennis now.
There
Fun
we go.
fact.
Not you and me, of course. The
No.
royal we, Italians.
Anyone with a last name that ends in a vowel.
Yeah.
Right. Should we do the roundup?
I'm finally going to be Leo Messi for Halloween this year.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
Now that you don't have a beard, you're going to be Leo Messi for
I'm
Halloween?
growing out beard for Leo Messi.
Okay, good.
I actually, that reminds me, I need to order. I feel like Messi, Barcelona, or Argentina. I don't. Barcelona, I feel like, is the one that you see most often.
Yeah, but Argentina is now the classic look.
Okay. The like.
It's the most messy.
And you know what the thing is? I feel like Jan did this. She was just like a witch for Halloween, like 10 years straight, right?
Yeah, you could be messy as long as you want to be.
When you stumble into the right costume, this is actually the mark of being an adult. Because when you're a kid, you have to think about a new costume every year. When you're an adult, you're like, that's my costume that I'm doing. I'm Leo Messi forever now.
That's why that person was still going as the Hanging Chad and How I Met Your Mother. All right, the roundup.
Ted Mosby, the star of the show, is that person to you?
Oh, Ted was the Hanging Chad, of course. Yes, that's right. Yeah, that makes sense
He's
because he
looking for the
was
slutty
Slutty
pumpkin.
Pumpkin. Yeah, okay.
God.
Okay. Fine, I hadn't thought about it in a minute.
A miracle that you would call the star of the show that.
Know, someone would say that Ted's claim to fame is. All
How dare
right.
you say that about Timo's?
Seattle Kraken start rookie camp on Thursday. Before that, they signed defender Adam Larson, who will not be at rookie camp as he is a veteran, to a 4-year, $21 million contract extension. Only a modest increase from Larson's $4.5 million salary on a per year basis up to $5.25 million, but takes him through his age 36 season. So could be a years, not dollars situation on this one. We'll see. Larson was second to Vince Dunn in ice time per game last season. All right, Sounders, as we talked about, a bizarre game in Columbus changed dramatically when crew keeper Abraham Romero was sent off in first half stoppage time. Columbus was already without its top two choices in goal, Patrick Schulte and Nicholas Hagan, due to international duty, with Evan Bush out injured. Their USL goalkeepers had already used their full allotment of short-term contracts and would have had to be signed for the rest of the season. As a result, they were not available, and that forced defender Sean Zawadzki between the sticks the rest of the game. Rushnak subsequently scored the free kick to give the Sounders the lead, then added two more after halftime for his hat trick. Jordan Morris also scored in the second half.
This is the best thing that could happen in all of soccer, right?
Like, I didn't understand the context until much later. I just saw, like, oh, Columbus's keeper. I saw people talking about it in the Discord, like how it just became a training session. And I was like, that's weird. Like, teams get reduced to 10 all the time. It keeps happening to the Sounders this season. But now that I understand the defender and goal part of it, and not just for the short period that Alex Roldan once saw out a Sounders win.
I'm telling you, doing something like that is how you be remembered in history. I know the name
Oh, well.
Kendall Hinton just because of one random start at quarterback.
You're saying that's claim to fame?
Claim to flame. Yeah. The
If Kendall hadn't won, would that have been a miracle?
maybe. The Alex Roldan thing, it came up with Chris.
Of
At like
course.
that's like a notable moment in Sounders history.
100%.
I feel like it'd be also kind of fun as the defender.
You know what the funny thing about it is? I mean, I don't think it would be actually. Playing goal sucks.
But one time where you're like,
Well, if you
there's no
win.
stakes.
I remember Alex Roldan playing goal so much more than I remember any of these hat tricks before in Sounders history.
Oh, yeah. Or even MLS Cups.
I don't know if I would go that far. I definitely remember MLS Cups. Stefan Fry missed this game due to concussion protocol. Hope is he'll be cleared this week. Raul Ruiz Diaz did not travel due to a knee injury after Sounder at Heart reported last week that he's told the team he won't return in 2025 due to his unhappiness with his role and tension in the locker room. He's expected to be available this week too. Joao Paulo was lost last week with a calf strain suffered in training. He will not be back this week. Expected to sideline him 2 to 3 weeks. Sounders up to fifth in the West again, although they're still sixth in points per match. Another chance to get road points Saturday at Sporting KC against a team that sits 12th in the West standings at 1 point per match. Break up the Seattle Reign. They earned their second consecutive 3-2 win on the road and third consecutive win overall since the Olympic break. Again, came back from an early deficit as Alyssa Thompson opened the scoring for Angel City in the 8th minute. Pacifica Huerta equalized from the spot in the 31st minute, her second consecutive game with a penalty. Ji So Yoon put the Reign ahead late in first half stoppage time, and Ziara King made it three in a row in the 58th minute. That allowed the Reign to overcome old friend Sydney LaRue, who played with Alex Morgan for those Sounders women before playing for the Reign, scoring in the 99th minute after multiple Angel City goals were called back. Marion managed to get the win despite Jess Fischlock leaving in the 17th minute due to injury. Have not heard yet about her availability for this weekend. The Reign will host a rare Monday game next week
Interesting.
against Gotham FC, which come in fourth in the standings. The Reign are up to 10th now, just 3 points out of the last playoff spot.
Okay.
All right, Seattle Storm have won two in a row. Since completing their road trip, after we last recorded, they lost at New York in the final game of their four-game stretch against the top two teams, or two of the top three, at least, in the WNBA. Came home, got a real feel-good victory against Phoenix, just blew out the really Mercury, their biggest win of the season in that one. And then Tuesday night was more of a struggle against the last-place Los Angeles Sparks, who have now locked in the top odds in the WNBA draft lottery, so may be able to start trying a little bit more. And they led in the late third quarter of this game, but Storm did manage to come from behind a big effort on Tuesday night from Gabby Williams, who made a bunch of threes in the first half. Was very exciting to see. She finished with 17 points on 6 of 10, 3 steals, 2 blocks, 4 assists. Just filling out the stat line. Skylar Diggins-Smith, 26 points on 10 of 13 shooting. So she continues to play very well since the Olympic break. Storm finish up this quick road trip on against Phoenix, taking on, or no, I'm sorry, that's not against Phoenix. They're in Dallas, I should say, on Friday night, then back home on Sunday to face the LA Sparks, and then next Tuesday, the Las Vegas Aces, a game that will go a long ways toward determining fourth and fifth in the WNBA standings and who has home court advantage in what will almost certainly be a series between the Storm and Aces. Now, even if the Storm win that, they'd still have to see the Aces lose at some point in order to move up to fourth, because right now that would tie the season series 2-2. And right now the Aces win the next tiebreaker, which is record against teams 500 or better. So Storm still needs some help in order to finish fourth. But, very excited as we head into the season will end a week from Thursday at Phoenix. We're coming down to it in the WNBA
Okay.
season.
Wow. I watched the end of the Sparks game.
Any
Pretty
takeaways?
solid. That I don't know. Not really. Did you have any takeaways?
No, I think, again, Skylar Diggins-Smith, and then it was great to see Gabby Williams play so well. She's had two strong games in a row. All right, let's preview the Apple Cup. The Huskies 4.5 point favorites over Washington State in a game to be played at Lumen Field as part of this new 5-year deal is a non-conference game between the Huskies and the Cougars, sort of resetting the rivalry so that it can return to campus sites in Pullman next year. And then alternate there through the remainder of this 5-year deal. I guess actually, let's start at the top. Some news involving Washington State. John Wilner reported Wednesday night that the Pac-12 is set to announce as early as Thursday that Boise State, Colorado State, San Diego State, and a fourth school believed to be Fresno State are joining from the Mountain West in 2026-27. So this is basically what I've been saying all along, which is there's no scenario where the Pac-12 and all that branding and history would actually go away, and that most likely they would become the Mountain West. The fact that it's only four schools from the Mountain West is interesting. They still need to add at least two to get to the NCAA minimum of eight in a conference. You'd think if it was other Mountain West schools, they'd all come together, but maybe that will come together later. Or perhaps they are looking elsewhere, whether it's, teams from Conference USA or whatever it is.
Yeah. I mean, it kind of came out of nowhere a little bit, just how quickly it was.
For
This
sure.
wasn't something that, I mean, obviously there's not the same level of infrastructure and people talking about, schools in the Mountain West or the remaining Pac-12 teams, but I thought this was kind of cool. This is going to be a fun conference. Have it, and honestly, Oregon State and Wazoo make a lot of sense with these teams. We don't write these teams off and say, in the way that I feel like sometimes Wazoo and Oregon State fans have felt like what was going to happen to their programs. Ultimately, water kind of found its level here, and the programs that they've now taken so far have, I think, for the most part, been the right programs to rebuild around. I'm not really surprised by any of it. I feel like UNLV was one that stood out to me, and
Right.
Colorado State as the other one were two programs that I think
Colorado
are,
State's
or
in this.
Colorado State are one of them. Okay, wait, hold on. UNLV then being the only one, really.
I don't know if I could
I mean,
name
New
all of them.
Mexico, San Jose State, Utah State, Wyoming, maybe Wyoming. It's kind of like, and then, Hawaii or whatever, but like,
It is also funny, like, so then you'll recall that originally these schools that are in the Mountain West, I don't know if it's for sure all of these ones, but many of them were in the WAC. And then like the
yes.
WAC expanded too much. And they were like, no. We need to take the best schools from this group and form our own conference. And that was the Mountain West. And then the Mountain West just became the old WAC. And like they had the Hawaii issue again of the having to travel to play them on a regular basis. And now the solution is to leave the Mountain West and form another new West Coast Conference, although now it has the upside of being on some level the premier West Coast Conference, even if it doesn't have the premier West Coast teams.
I wonder, is that, do you think there's a chance? It seemed like the Big 12 is less interested in adding basketball schools.
UConn thing is not happening, yes.
Well,
Or
for now.
Gonzaga.
The UConn thing is not happening for now. If they cared that, obviously UConn is a different proposition than Gonzaga, because UConn wanted to be more or less eventually the path to being a full member of the Big 12, right? And the value add from football is different. Breaking up the football pie is different than breaking up the basketball pie. So there's a little bit of a difference with UConn than Gonzaga. But do you think there's a chance that maybe this conference also has a basketball component and is able to pick off a couple of those West Coast basketball powerhouses as well?
I think that's plausible. I mean, I don't know if I could give you a percentage odds of it, but it's plausible.
I mean, there's still like the name of being in the Pac-12 means more than the name of being in the West Coast Conference.
Absolutely.
So, again, I think this is a good solution. I love the idea that people thought that or Oregon State would get absorbed into the Mountain West. It definitely felt like a call an ambulance type situation.
I mean, again, this has been my position from day one, this idea that the Pac-12 is dead. Like, yes, obviously the Pac-12 as we know it will not be constituted again, but there's just like those brands are way more valuable, and this is how it works. Like other conferences become other conferences. Like the American is what Conference USA used to be. The Mountain West is what the WAC used to be. Like that's just how it works.
What you're
Teams are
saying is
constantly moving up.
deserved overconfidence.
I don't know that I would connect those things necessarily. Well,
You said this is, you had been saying this would happen for a very long time. You had deserved overconfidence about the
no,
issue.
because it was the appropriate amount of confidence the whole time.
Oh, that's how I feel about Jed Fish and also Mike McDonald. I just had appropriate confidence.
Okay, we'll see. Well, you know who's also feeling pretty confident after their start is the Cougars, who have been impressive and starting 2-0. They hung 70 points on Portland State in their opener, winning 70 to 30, then crushed Texas Tech 37-16 in Pullman in an unofficial tribute to the late Mike Leach against his first team. They come in number 20 in the country in FBI efficiency, a stat where the Huskies so far rank 31st.
That's not great.
We mentioned John Mateer's QBR earlier, and QBR loves a running quarterback, and there's not a lot that are running more than John Mateer. The offense has really shifted with him replacing Cam Ward after spending the last 2 years on the bench. Now he's a redshirt sophomore. Their 21.5 pass attempts per game thus far rank 118th in FBS, while their 262.5 rushing yards per game rank 15th. Mateer carried 21 times for 197 yards against Texas Tech, has a rushing TD both games, a long rushing TD, in fact. He was the first Washington State quarterback to crack 100 yards on the ground since Tim Rosenbaugh in 1987.
Wow. I can't think of any Wazoo running quarter. I mean, Cam Ward, I guess, a little bit, but
it's truly not their style. And even, I don't know that Cam Ward necessarily like put up huge rushing totals.
He was able to run, though.
For sure. But he also is a very good passer. I mean, yeah, last year he had 144 total yards rushing all season. Obviously, sacks are a big factor in that, but he is not a rusher primarily. I was curious who was the last Husky quarterback to run for 100 yards. Is like Jake Locker had to do it. I don't know if anyone would have done it since him.
Probably not.
Of the Jakes, Christ. Locker was no the only Jakes. One who was going to be running
Jake
for
Browning
a lot of
probably
yards.
Wouldn't have.
So.
Are you looking that up?
That's going to take a second. So,
The thing that does make me a little bit nervous about this, I mean, there's partially just, I don't think that Texas Tech had the time to game plan for this offense that they were going to face. You know,
you don't.
There was one game of sample size from John Mateer, and also I think Texas Tech is probably quite a bad defense overall. But it's now that like the book is out on Wazoo. They are looking to run the ball at John Mateer. The goal is obviously to try to make them as.
Oh, I know who the last one was.
Siler Miles.
Yeah, I bet he did in that game against Oregon State when he started. Yeah, he ran for a lot of yards.
Even.
Oh, no, he never got to 100 in a game, though. He topped out at 89 rushing, so maybe not. Yeah,
100
I mean,
yards is a lot to get to when sacks are included.
I mean, the truly amazing thing, because I was thinking of how many times has UW done this since then? And I remember that Marcus Tuiasosopo once ran for 200 yards in a game. And he also passed for 300 yards in the same game. It was pretty good, guys.
But the one thing that this Husky defense, it hasn't actually borne out necessarily in stats. Richie Munoz had 4 carries for 19 yards for Weber State, which is fine. And then Cole Snyder ended up with 15 carries somehow. Maybe those were, I don't know how he ended up with so many carries. He did have the long one that he fumbled on, but it has seemed, when watching the games, more than statistically, like this UW defense hasn't dealt with running quarterbacks particularly well. So that's where I'm kind of fascinated what it's actually going to look like against a very good one. Because, again, statistically, I think they seem fine against running quarterbacks. The actual seeing them play against them, I have been less confident. And if you were to sort of draw up right now, how does a probably talent-wise worse team beat this UW team, especially against this UW defense? To me, a running quarterback is kind of the thing. You know, if it was somebody who was dropping back and throwing the ball like old school Mike Leach football, I think we'd feel fine about this game. But just the uniqueness of who they're playing makes me a little bit more concerned for it.
I think it's different. Like in a situation where you're trying to shut everything else down, I think it's easier for the scramble to be the one thing you leave open. That is not going to be their approach to this. They are going to be fully focused on shutting down Mateer as a runner. And I do think that might open up some other opportunities for Wazoo. But I mean, he can still be successful as a runner anyway. I just don't think like you can take a look at these first two games against quarterbacks that don't run that frequently and apply them to a quarterback who does, I guess
they
is what I would say.
They basically defensively just can't get complacent. They can't get to the place that they just...
And they can't have undeserved confidence?
That they can't forget about him as a runner. And I think because it could be a 3rd and 20 and that still could be a first down on the ground. You know, I guess that's kind of my concern is like just forgetting about Jon Matier. You know, they can't Game of Thrones kind of just forget about them, right?
Yeah,
So
I'm not that worried about that.
really.
Forgetting about him? No. No. Again,
Are getting too focused on being one-dimensional.
I think
But
this is going to be their
maybe they'll just
number
beat it.
one concern
Maybe
going
they'll
into
just
this
beat it.
game.
And who knows? But I'm less confident. Do you have any idea who Wazoo's offensive coordinator is? It's Jake
Ben,
Dickert.
it's Ben Arbuckle. Jake Dicker is the defensive coach. Ben
Okay.
Arbuckle was Cam Ward's offensive coordinator, who sort of he followed him from, I believe, Incarnate Word.
Oh,
But he
yeah.
was known as more of like an air raid style offensive coordinator. So this is a bit of a change.
I
Like
guess it kind of depends on both Jon Matier's skill and his ability to, if the Huskies are trying to make this team, if what they're saying is throw the ball downfield, do it, try us, throw the ball downfield, we are going to stop Jon Matier running. Is the scheme going to be good enough after that to be able to exploit it? And I'm a little bit less convinced of that. So if there's one thing that makes me more positive about it, that this defense can kind of focus in on Jon Matier. Also, they just haven't given up a touchdown yet. So until it happens, I said this during the Kalen DeBoer season, until we've been proven otherwise, I'm going to assume that this UW defense is quite good.
I'm going to assume that too. I'm going to assume they're good at least. True freshman Wayshon Parker has been their most effective running back thus far. He had 8 carries for 96 yards plus a 52-yard receiving touchdown against Portland State, and then 11 carries for 69 yards and a touchdown against Texas Tech. Juvenski Slenbaker had 2 short touchdowns on the ground versus Texas Tech. He's gotten a lot more work, but fewer yards per carry. No WSU receiver had more than 54 yards against Texas Tech, but both Chris Houston and Kyle Williams topped 100 yards against Portland State. Matier averaged nearly 20 yards per pass attempt against Portland State, but then was just 9 of 19 for 115 yards as a passer against Texas Tech. And that's why I do not think the Huskies are forgetting about him as a runner under any circumstances. The Washington State defense held Texas Tech QB Baron Morton to 5.6 yards per attempt, picked him off twice in addition to recovering a fumble. So it was probably as impressive a defensive performance, I would say, in week two as an offensive one for Washington State.
Still a little difficult this time of season to really know what to make of them, and for any college team for that matter, really, like
Yeah.
this early on, it really kind of just depends on how good you think Texas Tech is. It's still a Power Five win though, and a pretty comfortable Power Five win. So I think there definitely are some concerns. Again, I just with Jonah Coleman back there, physically speaking, like this Wazoo team is not going to be able to stop the UW run with the amount of backs that they have. If things are clicking offensively, like they're going to run the damn ball. And I think they probably should. It was kind of the thing that bothered me the most early on in the game against Eastern was that Jonah Coleman wasn't getting those carries early on. You know, they came out wanting to pass. And really, this is like, I think they probably didn't want to use Jonah Coleman that much. But this game might be a little bit more of like, we're going to ride Jonah Coleman. We're going to ride Cam Davis. We're going to ride Adam Muhammad. And give a bunch of carries to these folks and then open things up for Will Rogers, who might have a very efficient day, but also be near like 80% completion percentage with like 200 some yards, just because they're not having to pass a ton.
Well, he's got to be 22 of 26. That's 85%. It's a high bar.
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how much the game plan they came out with against Eastern Michigan was based on what they expected them to do defensively in response to the run. Also, they just, kind of had a hard time staying on script because they didn't pick up first downs early in the game. I would say the other thing about having the depth that they do at running back is like you don't need to be afraid to, have repeated runs if you're rotating through multiple guys in that spot.
And we talked about this all offseason about just how many running backs there are. Like, there's more beyond there. I think that's the pretty clear 1, 2, and 3. But Daniel Nata, Sam Adams, like, these are backs that can go pick up yards for you if you need them.
Daniel Nata notably was in the game on that 4th and 1. I can't remember if it was the original or after they came back after the timeout. Originally, I think it called a run to Coleman, and then he came out of the huddle for the Giles Jackson bootleg, play action bootleg. So that was interesting.
There's also another piece that I think, statistically speaking, I feel like this game favors UW a little bit more than it does in the spread. And I think people are maybe a little bit overrating Wazoo maybe underrating that this game is happening in Seattle. And I think this UW team so far has been pretty underrated overall as a team. They haven't gotten the respect from the odds makers that they probably should have.
Yeah, I mean, it's tough to know exactly what to make of this. Like, the only time these two teams have played at Lumen Field, it was technically a Husky home game as part of, the renovations of Husky Stadium and them playing at Lumen Field the entire next season. This time, it's like, allotments for both schools. It is like a neutral site setup. Obviously, it's an advantage for UW. They're just having to take a bus as opposed to Washington State having to presumably fly here or bus here. And you get to, I guess you probably stay in a hotel anyway, given the way that college teams usually operate. And it's not a venue you're familiar with. You've not played on the field. So it'll be interesting to see what kind of advantage there is.
I think this should be like an 8.5 point spread, though. 4.5 felt a little too low to me.
That feels too high to me. I would say 6.5 tops.
Okay, then. Percentage chances of victory.
62.
I'm going to say it's like a 70, 76% chance. I have a healthy amount of concern for Wazzu, but I actually think this game is easier in September than it is in December,
Oh, they
November.
never played it in December, but late November in terms of the in
Just
terms of
also
the
the build up for it and everything. There's something about it being the last game. Like, this isn't the level of rivalry where, there's furious hatred on each side.
There's furious hatred on one side.
I still don't know. I don't know if it's quite there. And it's obviously a big game for Wazzu. Their schedule looks very different. Those players blame you, Dub. College football is so different than it was, though. In the transfer portal era, it's not like a lot of these players have been there and toiled away and been like, oh man, UW really screwed us. These rosters turn over quite a bit. There was a tweet from Jonah Coleman on like fucking Saturday being like, or whatever, a post from him being like, sometimes I miss being back home in Arizona. And I was like, damn. It's kind of crazy. But also, Jonah Coleman just up and changed his life not that long ago. So of course he misses Arizona. He played multiple seasons there. I think that the relationship to the school is less than it has ever been.
Yeah, I still think though there's an element of like everywhere you go on campus this week, everyone is gonna be saying "fuck you, Dub," and
I guess
understandably
so. Are
so.
they? I guess they're in school already. UW's not even in school. Like,
This is a fair point, yes, which is part of the unusual part nature of playing this game in September.
I think playing it at the end of the season, there's so much build up for it. It's after Thanksgiving. It's after everything else has happened. The stakes are significantly higher. Like the spoiler aspects of it. There's so much more on tape. But also at the same time, UW's kind of fairly consistently dominated this rivalry over the last, decade plus. We're talking about one win.
We're gonna limit it to a decade plus. I mean, yes, in the past, it's been very lopsided in that span, especially relative to how good Washington State has done overall. They've had many excellent seasons.
But we're talking about one single win in that time period. So, is this the team?
I don't know that I would think of it that way.
After, I mean, obviously the circumstances of when it did happen, when they did beat UW, like that was probably it. Honestly, we weren't even upset about it. We were like, yeah, our coach pushed a player and was fired. They're these strange interim coaches. Like, it's going to all be different next year. And then they were back on track. So
You're going to be feeling very different by kickoff time on Saturday, I think. You're going to have worked up a healthy animosity by then.
only if Ben's with us.
Oh.
Is John Mateer the guy that beats UW?
I just don't think that's the way to think of it.
I know that if we get down by even like 3 points, you'll glare at me.
You're just coming out and saying undeserved talking. You're complaining about people talking about perfect games in progress, and then you're talking about this.
There's a difference between something that's happened 24 times ever in the history of like the longest running sport in America,
Yeah, that makes it
and
less
there's
likely that
good
you're actually
coaches
jinxing.
all the time.
I suppose. I don't know if I buy this logic.
The Huskies almost consistently just keep hiring good coaches.
It makes almost consistently. Almost to doing a lot of work there. All right, let's talk about the
Also,
Seahawks.
for us few Tyron Willingham apologists, the streak stretches even further.
I don't think Tyron Willingham is nearly as bad as people think. He gets a lot of the blame for the fact that they were overscheduled at that point and then have been severely underscheduled ever since.
That's fine. I'm fine with it.
Tyron Willingham's out there wondering why he didn't get to play Weber State.
I can tell you that they could have dropped a Weber State every year in the Tyron Willingham schedule, and his fate would have been the same. I think his perspectives about punting probably
Oh, not great. Not
it
great.
would not have been very modern.
Oh, not ideal. I'm just saying, Tyron Willingham takes too much of the blame.
He would have seen that play that the exact opposite way that Jed Fish saw it, the fourth and one.
Yes, that is fair. But then so would Don James in all likelihood. So the Seahawks created 9.5. Oh, we did percentage chance. Seahawks created 9.5 million cap space by converting 11.875 million of DK Metcalf's base salary into a signing bonus and adding 3 void years, which is very different than they've usually only used 1 void year at most in their contracts. That 7.1 million there would be dead cap in 2026 if the Seahawks don't extend or re-sign Metcalf before his current contract concludes, which seems to be an indicator they expect to extend DK Metcalf next season.
Yes.
Which also, it might be easier to just have extended him now, but oh, we have our principle. We don't do it until the last year of the contract. Can never stray from that. New England Patriots. They had the NFL's lowest over under after going 4-13 last season and then firing Bill Belichick. But they shocked the Cincinnati Bengals. It was a miracle win over the Cincinnati Bengals as 7.5 point underdogs on Sunday in Jerod Mayo's debut as head coach. They were outgained on a per play basis, averaged just 4.8 yards per pass, but took advantage of a Cincinnati fumble with a two and a fumbled punt that set up a New England field goal.
I didn't even know the circumstances of how they won that game.
You just saw the score.
I mean, I was sort of like monitoring the score along the day, but it's one of those things, like Urban Meyer was saying, every game's like playing against Alabama.
That is true. Yeah.
You could be the Cincinnati Bengals and have one of the, have a high over under and have lost in week one to the team with the lowest.
Jacoby Brissett started at quarterback over number three pick Drake May. He completed 62.5% of his passes, but for just 5.0 yards per attempt before taking out sacks. Brissett did run for 32 yards, including a 16-yard scramble on 3rd and 5 that set up New England's lone touchdown. Mayo joked afterwards that Brissett is probably the slowest black quarterback in the league.
You know who cannot say that is
Geno Smith? Scramble Geno Smith?
QB1, fastest player on the Seahawks, Geno Smith. Did you see that miles per hour? Number
Yeah, I did
one.
not see that. Well, that was in week
QB1,
one.
Geno Smith in week one hit the fastest top speed of
That's it.
anybody in the on the team.
There was that training thing this offseason where he had the highest speed score of anybody on the team, right? Am I
Yeah.
remembering this correctly?
People don't
Geno's just
understand
getting
Geno
faster
Smith.
in his old age.
Not even deceptive, just fast.
Let's go.
That scramble was awesome.
It was a very important play in the game. Enjoyed it very much. Seven different Patriots caught passes, including former Husky Jalen Polk in his NFL debut.
Oh, I wouldn't say he caught passes.
Okay, sorry, caught pass. I didn't read the story, but I'm told the advanced stats were more positive. Like, must be PFF grading, liked what he was doing as a blocker, etc. None had more than 31 receiving yards. So, if you're wondering how the Seahawks defense is going to look when it gets tested deep, you're probably still going to be wondering that after this. It was, however, a big opener for one of my fantasy players, Ramondre Stevenson, with 25 carries for 120 yards and a touchdown. It was just his fifth career 100-yard game, his first since 2022. They relied heavily on him. Antonio Gibson had 7 carries off the bench unsuccessfully.
So I think one of the interesting bits about it, I don't know if you've mentioned this, the Patriots ended up eighth in DVOA after that game, right? Because played fairly solid on both sides of the ball. And I think the piece that's
No,
different.
that's not the reason they ended up that high. It's because they were number one in special teams DVOA.
I'm seeing number eight in special teams.
Am I misremembering this? I thought for sure that was the case.
I believe number one was that was the Dallas Cowboys.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, it's like 15 offense, 11 defense, 8 special teams. They played like a fine game overall. But the difference is for the Seahawks, where they jumped up to 10th in Dave, which is kind of the predictive tool, the Patriots only jumped up to 22nd.
Right. They
And
had a
obviously,
long more to go.
they were starting further down, but the Seahawks being a top 10 team makes a lot more sense to me than the Patriots being a top 10 team. And I think the Patriots being at 22nd is still even probably a little rosy. And given those stats, like, sure, ride Ramondre Stevenson, probably not going to last the entire season long, especially when your quarterback is completing 5 yards per attempt. And especially not even at that high of a completion percentage either. You know, if you're going to only complete five, only gain 5 yards per attempt, you might as well want to complete a lot of those.
Yes, I would agree.
So it
Well, the Seahawks
kind
started
of.
out 13th in DVOA. DVOA was on it. Patriots also were 24th in DVOA, which is interesting
Okay.
given that 32nd, the last in over under.
This Patriots team is probably not as bad as the over under.
I would say they are almost certainly not as bad as the over under now.
But also, they might be a better team than their wins and losses indicate. They're in a tough division. And I mean, they should be playing in fourth place schedule, right? Or at least a third place schedule. But no, they were definitely, the Jets were definitely better than them. So a fourth place schedule overall. But this Patriots team is probably not as bad as that. But also, if you were to draw up a team that the Seahawks team should be able to defend, it is this Patriots team. And offensive touchdowns, if the over-under is 1.5, what would you pick?
Probably take the under.
Yeah.
I mean, they only
So
scored one touchdown last week.
yeah. So if you have a team, I mean, you all of a sudden need the defense to be really good consistently or end up with really opportunistic plays to win a game like that. If right now you're taking the under 2 touchdowns in the game, I mean, you need to make any special teams plays turn into touchdowns. You need to make any defensive plays turn into big plays. And I just don't think this is the kind of offense that's going to allow that to happen.
But I mean, yeah, that's
Again,
the
for another week.
maybe for a half. I mean, the Patriots defense is good. Like, even as bad as this team was last season, it was entirely the offense. The defense was pretty good. They held Joe Burrow to 164 yards, which was his lowest in a full game since the 2023 season opener. Although it was more yards per attempt than he had in five of like the 11 or 10 or 11 games he played last season, including against both the Seahawks and against Mike McDonald's Ravens in his healthy matchup. Yeah, they finished ninth in defensive DVOA last season. So this is, and you know, that's Gerard Mayo's side of the football. So this is a team that I do think will be difficult defensively, probably in a similar ballpark, I would say, to Denver.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. But I mean, the Seahawks had drives against Denver.
They did.
And they had big plays against them, and especially depending on Ken Walker's health. I thought it was so funny. I felt like this offseason, people were kind of writing off Tyler Lockett. And Tyler Lockett coming up with the game that he had, the catch that he made to win it, that was very impressive. But I also just hope that we can all acknowledge we're now on year three. Plus a handful of games the previous season of Geno Smith as Seahawks starting quarterback. Can we please not treat every game like a referendum on Geno Smith anymore and
I'm
just
sorry.
acknowledge?
How many years was Russell Wilson the starting quarterback, and every game was a referendum on Russell
Russ had
Wilson?
bad games and nobody, people didn't freak out that much. He had a bunch of them.
And did they? Maybe they treated it more as a referendum on the offense and the offensive
Yes.
coordinator, and in our case, Pete Carroll. But I don't know. I think this is what discourse is.
Discourse. But can we just not, if Geno Smith doesn't play an amazing game against a probably pretty good Patriots team,
I'm
can we
happy
not
to
treat this as a referendum on Geno Smith, obviously good NFL quarterback?
not do that.
Great. That's all I ask. Because there's a chance that Geno Smith doesn't have amazing numbers coming out of this game because the Patriots defense is good. And if Ken Walker isn't fully available, it's funny. I don't know if I believe that running backs matter positively, but I do feel like running backs can matter negatively. And
Well, I think this is
as a.
why Seahawks fans have like been so conditioned to believe that running backs matter, is they have never, since it's been a very long period of time, Who was the last one? I mean, I guess when Chris Carson emerged as a rookie is the last time that like a guy has risen up the depth chart and been successful. Because
Well, it's also because Pete Carroll keeps drafting really high running backs.
anytime those highly drafted running backs go out of the lineup, they do in fact struggle. So I don't know why the Seahawks are the exception that proves the rule
Well,
in terms of reserve running back success. That, by the way, Jordan Mason looked pretty damn good. He might not be Christian McCaffrey, but he looked pretty damn good playing in the 49ers offense on Monday.
Zach Charbonnet was also a quite highly drafted running back as well, all things considered. It's not like Zach
I'm
Charbonnet was an
aware.
undrafted free agent, seventh round pick,
Zach
but
Charbonnet did have a big moment on Sunday.
no, and I'm happy that he had that catch, but like as a runner, Ken Walker looked way better than Zach Charbonnet. And
He
on
did,
that
yes.
last drive, when Charbonnet was in and not Ken Walker, we didn't know at the game. I didn't know that he was injured or whatever. And I was like, Ken Walker must be hurt because he hasn't been out there. But he was standing on the sideline looking like he was ready to come in. And
I mean, we didn't. I don't know that we knew at the time that he was injured.
okay, that wasn't
I
like a
think
story on the TV broadcast.
I can't remember for sure, but I think we were just surmising it from the same as you.
Yeah.
Yeah,
There
I mean,
looked like a
also,
difference between them as runners. I would have felt more confident heading into that series where they needed a first down if Ken Walker was back there and not Charbonnet, just to be honest.
I suppose so. Short yardage running is not necessarily Ken Walker the third strength. We should note, great decision by Mike McDonald to try to throw. First off, awesome. The play that nobody talks about is Geno drawing the offsides, hard counting and drawing the offsides, which nearly picked up a first down on the field and then gave them a second chance at a shorter first down. Just A plus effort there from Geno Smith, a thing that feels like it always happens against your team and never for your team. And then, secondly, Mike McDonald being willing to pass in that situation, correctly noting on Monday on the coach's show that the difference between no timeouts and one timeout in that situation is really quite marginal. That what is much more, much bigger fa factor in your chance of victory is picking up the first down and ending the game. So that was 100% the right call. And then you mentioned Lockett. Geno delivered a ball where only Tyler Lockett could catch it, the only place that Tyler Lockett could catch it. And Tyler made a difficult catch. Just terrific. Everybody executed all around.
I just want to, Ken Walker, how many carries did he have overall in the game?
I believe it was 21, somewhere in that ballpark.
Okay, so he had probably 20. Is there a place like 20 carries where I can look to see? I mean, given that he had a 23-yard carry, there were a couple of short ones in there, but I felt like he was doing a pretty good job of picking up consistent yards.
There
And
was some pretty big negative ones in there. Some why are you running that direction? Ken
that is
Walker the third,
a little bit
the
of the
line of scrimmage
Ken
the
Walker
other way.
experience. But first carry was 8 yards, then 3 yards, which is fine. -3 yards. Okay, that was a bad series for Ken Walker.
Yes.
oh, there was a penalty on the first play, and then another -3 yards. So that was a brutal series for him. Did he come back in this series? 3 yards. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong with this, to be honest.
Pro Football Reference has him at a 45% success rate, which was ranked 30th of 48 running backs.
Yeah.
Charbonnet was at 37.5. I mean,
I
again,
gotta
that's
say, looking at
more a
this
product of the
individually,
offensive line.
even on the touchdown, it was like 3 yards, -4 yards. There were a lot more negative plays than I remember.
Oh, they were pretty visceral for me.
Pass to Ken Walker for -2 yards, and then up the middle for 9. Well, anyway, I felt like in the second half, he did that. And that's a little bit more like, yeah, the long touchdown drive that they had, it was like 5 yards, 6 yards, 4 yards, 23 yards. Just bang, 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 bang.
And Ryan Grubb like settled in terms of his play calling in the second half and
I
was
think that
mixing
is,
it up well.
I think that is part of the element as well. We'll see against this Patriots defense. I mean, I think it'll be a fun enough game. You know, every time that we get to see this team play right now is fun because I think they're very good. And getting another chance to just view this defense, it's one of those things that you remember from the Legion of Boom era where it's like, I love watching the Seahawks overall, but I really love watching this defense play. So getting a chance for them to play Jacoby Brissett, I kind of can't wait for it. And I think they're actually going to win this game comfortably.
So the line on the total on this game is 38.5. It's down, it spread is down to Seahawks 3.5. I believe I had it as 4.5 in here in the notes when I looked earlier. The total was 38.5, which is the second lowest total of this weekend. The only lower one involves your guy, Bo Nix,
Oh yes.
against
No, it
Pittsburgh.
does. Oh man. Oh, Bo. Oh, he gets the Steelers after that. How are you feeling about your Steelers under, by the way?
Not great. I'm not feeling good about my Eagles under lock.
Appropriate overconfidence deserved.
All right, percentage chance is a victory.
72%.
That is very confident. I'm gonna
You're not that
go
confident?
60% on this one.
Is it how much has that changed because of the game against Cincinnati?
I don't know. Probably a little bit.
So basically to you, I mean, obviously their defense played well overall,
I
but they
think New
more or less.
England exceeded expectations more in week one than the Seahawks did. I mean, the Seahawks played exactly to their spread against Denver, which is not considered a good team. But when you consider the fluky plays that we talked about, I do think
Exactly.
they
Are you factoring in the fluky
improved them.
plays that the Patriots benefited from?
Yeah. But again, the like
I
bars, so they were on
don't
the
think you
road
are.
against a good team, and they were
The
expected to
Patriots
be the worst team in the NFL.
were on the road.
Yeah.
Wow, that's actually a pretty impressive win
It is a pretty impressive win. I agree.
then. But sometimes impressive wins happen because of a few bounces of the ball. And that is one that I kind of feel like that was the case for the Patriots in that game. And the Bengals such a notorious poor starting team. Like, I'm not that worried about it. I'm going to Vegas Saturday night, and I'm thinking Seahawks covering the spread is the vibe.
Well, I am looking forward to finding out what you have been overconfident about next week.
Thanks for
On that note,
listening.
thanks.
Appropriate confidence. You're going to find out that it was appropriate confidence.
We'll see.
I just like that you're going to blame me for everything. No
You're
matter
bl
what happens, unless they win, you'll be begrudgingly happy. But if any of these teams lose, like if the Huskies look bad against Wazoo, you're just going to revel in.
I won't be begrudgingly happy. I want the teams to win. I'm just saying, you can't get all upset at Dave Sims and then do the same thing.
I just feel like there's a difference.
I don't. I mean, also, the answer is neither of these things actually affect the outcome.
Dave
So they are
Sims
definitely the same.
doesn't affect the outcome.
Weird.
Us talking doesn't affect the outcome.
Who could have seen it
Oh
coming?
my God. I think Dave Sims does affect the outcome, though.
I do not think so. Unless
Maybe
he's secretly running the team.
being the commentator for the Mariners because of how bad their hitting generally is. Instantly makes you that much more likely to announce a perfect game.
That's fair. That's a good point.
If you want to announce history, the Mariners are the place to go. Yeah, Philip Humber was a random one.
It was.
I told the children though when it was the seventh inning, when you recorded the first out of the seventh inning, literally before it ended, I was like, Marco, you should come watch. Like, this is a thing that never happens. And then
Yeah, you can't do it
Mateo.
until the ninth.
Mateo thought, well, clearly I fucked it up because bam, one run homer, Tatis, right after I said that. Mateo said it couldn't be a perfect game because he threw a ball.
Oh, wow. High
I
standards.
was like,
Immaculate perfect game.
immaculate perfect game. I don't. An immaculate inning is nine straight strikes.
Yes.
But 27 pitch perfect game.
I suppose, yes.
That would be an actual perfect game. If every pitch you threw resulted in an out. That's what Mateo was looking for. I guess he was looking for one or the other. Anyway, his standards are high.